You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. We head over to one of England's most overlooked counties, Shropshire, to discover some rather unusual and odd stories from this county. Joining me to educate us is the wonderful Amy Boucher, writer and researcher, and of course, proud Salopian. Amy tells us tales of grumpy giants, witches, ghosts, the devil himself, and gives us the lowdown on the marvellous tale of the Shropshire Man-Monkey. But before we hear about the weird and wonderful Shropshire, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes. Thank you to my two latest patrons, Mary and Paul. Your support is greatly appreciated, as is all of you that support me on Patreon and make the show what it is today. Thank you, one and all. Mysteries and Monsters is on all social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. And don't forget, you can visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for episodes, news and merchandise. Thank you as always to Dean Bestall for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. And Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Now, let's hear all about the weird and wonderful history of some of the strange characters that have inhabited the county of Shropshire. Nestled between the Welsh border and Birmingham lies the county of Shropshire, a rural and sparsely populated area of England. A scenic and beautiful county, it's often overlooked by its noisy neighbours. Yet it has legends and lore that span centuries, from stories of the fae, giants, shooks and ghosts. The county has plenty to discover in the company of Amy Boucher. Amy, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Thank you for having me.
Nope, thanks for wanting to join me. It's always a pleasure. As we were saying before we started, Shropshire, I think, is one of those counties in the UK that always gets overlooked. It's kind of pushed out and misplaced, and people go past it or people go through it, and nobody seems to stop and have a look around at this beautiful little place. As a local, a Salopian, as they are known outside of their borders, what's it like growing up in one of those places that people just seem to either not know where it is or act as if you've just suddenly appeared in the United Kingdom when you're one of the oldest counties we've got?
Yeah. So I think it depends entirely on the sort of person you are. So someone like myself, who I'm a massive history nerd, I love folklore, I love the countryside. I feel so lucky to have grown up in an area like Shropshire that really facilitated my interests. And I'm a bit awkward. I don't like really being in a city. I find them quite like overwhelming. I think if you're a bit more of a kind of city goer, or you want a bit more kind of a nightlife, you might feel the struggle a little bit more. But it's certainly, if you're into all things weird and wonderful like folklore and anything a bit spooky, Shropshire is the place to grow up.
So what came first? Was it a love of history that sort of led you into folklore and magic and myth, or was it a bit of everything, or was it folklore that led you into history? I mean, sometimes these things work really well as we get older, Amy, and we suddenly realize just how connected these subjects really are underneath it all. So often one leads to the other, or did they all just start in tandem for you?
So I think I always say that I liked folklore before I knew really what folklore was. Mm. And that's because I grew up on these stories, and a lot of the stories I still tell today. For me, all of my interests, my interest in history, my interest in folklore and anything a bit weird and wonderful, has developed from growing up in Shropshire. So, for instance, Shropshire is a landscape that is really rich with folklore, folk tales, and also ghost stories. We seem to have more ghosts than, in my opinion, most places in the country.
My grandfather was a very good storyteller. He wasn't professional or anything like that, but he would make the most mundane story really come to life. And he would often retell us stories from the area. So, for example, the Wrekin Giant or some of the stories of Old Scratch. And he actually had an encounter with Old Scratch himself, he believed. He was said to have met the devil, and he would take great pleasure telling us these kind of stories. So I grew up with a real appreciation for kind of fairy tales and folklore without even really knowing it. And then I think with growing up in Shropshire, with being so richly, there's a lot of heritage and there's a lot of history. So you've got everything from the Industrial Revolution to the medieval period, literally just down the road from where I grew up. So I really developed a passion for the past, and in particular the people of the past, the way that human beings interpreted the past and how they navigated the world in which they lived in. And then as I've got older, I think all of my passions kind of merged, and I knew that I liked kind of anything a bit weird and wonderful because I'm a bit of a goth. And I knew that I was very passionate about the area that I grew up and our stories, and I love history, so it kind of all merged into becoming nearly knowledgeable. So I think it's a mixture of it all, really.
So did the passion sort of fire you up to start the blog and sort of look at bringing to light some of the stories your grandfather shared with you, Amy? Or was it one of those things that you didn't think that some of the stories or the legends or the history were getting their fair share of the limelight? Because as you say, I mean, Shropshire is somewhere that has areas of natural beauty. It's got some of the most picturesque parts of the countryside in the country in that particular county. You've got breathtaking views. You've got wonderful folk tales about how the Wrekin appeared, for a prime example, is one which is one of those stories that I wish I'd knew when I was dragged up it as an 8-year-old, I'll tell you that, because it probably would have made me want to climb it a bit quicker. So did you start the blog to sort of share your passion with the wider world about these particular stories, or was it just you thought this is the next best thing, I need to preserve these stories and get them out there?
It was actually a bit of everything. It was a bit of a happy accident. So I got to lockdown because I started it pretty much around the first lockdown, and I was working in the homeless shelter, and it was quite a challenging environment, and I'd really needed something, just as an outlet to unwind when I wasn't dealing with the fact we were sick or dealing with the nature of the work I did. So I decided I wanted to write a blog because I studied history at university, and then I kind of packed my history and got on with the real world and started working in different environments. So I knew that I wanted to share some of our stories. For instance, the first blog post I wrote about was the Sin Eaters and how Sin Eaters have contributed to Shropshire. And I knew that I wanted to share some of our stories, but I thought I would like to do more general history and kind of discuss things like the Viking, which I had an interest in, or kind of Welsh history. But I found that whenever I sat down to write about things, if I was writing about Shropshire, I found it very easy to write. Whereas if I was writing about another topic, it felt like it was, do you know when you're writing an essay for school and you don't really want to do it? It was really bizarre. It was like I wanted to write about early medieval Wales, but when I sat down to write about early medieval Wales, I wanted to do anything but it. Whereas with Shropshire, it just came naturally to me. And I think I noticed that it wasn't being represented in the same way that other areas are. So there's certain areas in the country that quite rightly, because they have in folklore, get a lot of representation, whereas Shropshire hasn't. And that really, from when I kind of clicked that wasn't getting the representation, spurred me to want to share these tales and ensure that not only are they preserved, but also that people hear them, because we have everything that any other place has, and then we also have some really unique, bizarre ones that kind of are brilliant in themselves and encapsulate the idea that Shropshire's neither, I've always said that Shropshire's neither England nor Wales, but it's kind of both. Traditionally, Shropshire is in England and it's part of England, but there's so much of a Welsh influence that it's not quite England, but equally it's not quite Wales because of the English influence, and it is a really fascinating place.
Yeah, I mean, it could have been worse. I mean, it could be one of those strange situations where neither country really wants you because you're either just over the border or just inside, depending on who's drawing the maps, Amy, sometimes.
Yeah.
And so it is difficult, I think, sometimes to untangle where Shropshire is these days, other than the fact, yes, of course, technically it's in England, but like you say, it is literally on the border. It's on the cusp of the of Wales, and therefore it would make sense that there would be some pollination of the legends and stories that would bleed across and vice versa. So I think it does seem quite odd. I think yourself and probably Herefordshire is another county that often gets overlooked. I think perhaps because they're smack bang next to Wales. So people either think they're Welsh or they just don't care.
Yeah, I think it's geography as well. Like I'm not very good at geography, to be honest. Everything blurs. For instance, I found out that Milan today wasn't in Spain, which was quite a shock, considering I'm teaching about the Milan and the plague tomorrow. but I don't think people necessarily know what Shropshire is. And if you don't know where an area is, you're not going to really know much about it. And I think through learning a little bit more about history and the history of the area, even growing up there, I didn't realise how important it was and how indicative it really was to British history. So I knew that there were a load of castles there, and I knew that the Welsh were constantly trying to get into England through Shropshire. But I didn't realise that at one point, the person that controlled Shrewsbury, for instance, or Wales, was one of the most important people in the country, other than the king, because if you had them on your side, they would keep the Welsh out. If you didn't have them on your side, there would be a clear route into England during the medieval period. And even little things like Henry VIII used to holiday in Ludlow sometimes, and his brother, before his brother died, had his honeymoon in Ludlow Castle. So it just fascinates me how important this place has been in history, and then how it's kind of gone by the wayside a little bit. So that's why I've kind of made it my cause to share the stories.
It is really, because obviously, like you say, throughout up until probably the 19th century, Shropshire was a very important part of England's history, regardless of what aspect you look at it. And like you touched on earlier, it was a key component of the Industrial Revolution. You know, this county did a lot to help drive the modernisation of England. And like you say, it is strange how places are so important to a certain point and they just fall away from the forefront of people's mind. Or maybe it's because they've heard so many stories about the devil wandering around Shropshire, Amy, that they've thought they don't want to go there. What's all this about? Why does the devil have a thing for Shropshire? What is it?
So I think possibly because it's the best county in the country. I think there's a lot of reasons. I think Shropshire and Mercia, back when we're going way, way back into the Anglo-Saxon period, was one of the last places in Britain to Christianise. So there was a lot of pagan influence in Mercia, and in Shropshire was part of Mercia, back when the kings of England and the different kingdoms were actually Christian. And I think that residual paganism has created a situation where you've got some things that are not quite paganism, but also not Christian either. And it's that brilliant area of folk belief that still has Christian ideas, but they seem a little bit older than the Christian concept, I say. I think as well as that, you've got things like the Methodist influence coming in from Wales. So in the 19th century, you have a lot, particularly in my part of Shropshire where I grew up, East Shropshire, with places like Elford today, there was a lot of Methodists. Anywhere really was a mining community, there was a strong Methodist influence. And Methodism sometimes can be a bit more hellfire and brimstone, and there's that real tangible idea of the devil being an entity you can fight in, it that exists in your day-to-day business rather than being this massive evil deity. So it's almost the devil becomes a bit more personified. And I think as well, there's certain areas in Shropshire that just give off a very otherworldly presence. And I think the best example of that is the Cipher Stones. There's something very liminal and almost supernatural about the area. So you can understand how that feeling could inspire stories about the devil.
I know when we were talking about when you first launched your blog, you mentioned the Sin Eaters, which I think for some people is a completely alien term. They're not going to have any sort of comprehension about who or what the Sin Eaters were or what they did, AB. So can you shed any light on these strange characters?
Yeah, of course. So there's several arguments about Sin Eaters, which I'll go into in a little bit. But the basic concept is if someone dies before they can have their last rites or anything really put in place for a Christian send-off, there's a belief that their soul might stay around and become a wandering ghost, which no village town needs. We've got enough ghosts in Shropshire, we don't need more of them. So what you do is, if you know, say, for example, the vicar isn't going to get to the village in time, because several villages in Shropshire, particularly the ones in South Shropshire, would have one vicar to several villages, so he'd have to walk between them, the poor. So if you knew that that was out of the question and he couldn't do the last rites, you'd get a Sin Eater. And a Sin Eater is a person that unfortunately tends to come from the lower ends of society, someone that's usually quite vulnerable. They might have existing issues with, say, alcohol, who are homeless or they're living in poverty, and they take on the job and the mantle of a Sin Eater in order to make some money, essentially. And it's a ritual that is almost a version of the last rites in Catholicism, where they ritually eat bread and ritually drink wine or beer over the person when they are either dead or close to death. And this is meant to symbolically take on the sins of that person. So by consuming the bread, you're consuming their sins. And by drinking the wine or the beer, you're consuming their sins as well. And that was in order to let that person go to heaven and save the village of ghosts. However, there is no Sin Eater for the Sin Eater. So that person who conceivably does that ritual multiple times in their lifetime has to know that they're going to go to hell and they are carrying around the sins of a lot of people. Now, there is only actually one mention about Sin Eaters in Shropshire. There's one reference from the 1700s. However, there's later versions of the practice being reenacted in the 19th and even the 20th century. There is an argument that says that perhaps it wasn't that prominent, but because the church had condemned eating, I personally feel that it probably did go on. It did happen. However, they weren't going to be screaming and shouting and writing about it because the church had condemned it. And one of the reasons why I think it did happen more than we necessarily know is because a chap called Richard Munslow in the 1800s, later end of the 1800s, actually reenacted the practice. So it had gone into decline. And he was from Ratlin Hope, which is also local known as Ratchup. And he was from Ratchup. He was a very wealthy man. He didn't really have any need for money or anything like that. But then all of a sudden, he started becoming the Sin Eater for the area. Now, there is a theory, which I tend to believe, that he did it to deal with his own grief, because he ended up losing 3 children in a very short space of time, 2 of which actually died in the same week due to illness. And I think that sin eating became his way of coping with the tragedy of their death. But for him to be able to reenact the practice and for him to be able to resurrect it, he's got to know about it in the first place. Now, it's not like Richard Munslow, he was a wealthy man, but it's not like he was a antiquarian or that he was well versed in folklore. It's got to have been relatively well known in his lifetime in order for him to have brought it back. So I do believe that sin eating may have happened more in Shropshire than we necessarily realise, but Richard Munslow was the last Sin Eater in Shropshire. And Sin Eaters prior to him tended to be kind of ostracised in the same way that a village might ostracise a witch. They would use them for their services, they would use them for the ritual, but they were condemned to suffer for the sins they'd taken on. They weren't allowed in polite company, and it was even seen as unlucky to lock eyes with a Sin Eater, lest some of that sin be transferred to you. So they were really quite ostracised and really quite lonely figures in society. And Richard Munslow changed that during his lifetime, because he was actually well respected in the community. And if you go to Ratchup, which is a lovely little village now in South Shropshire, you can actually go to his grave and it's still there. And he was buried with his children and his wife, so it was nice to think that they were all reunited after the death.
It is kind of strange when you look at these situations, Amy, where you have people who do situations or assist the community with jobs that no one else wants to touch, and then they kind of say, well, thanks for that, now you can get back to your cave, out the way, go on your way, we're not bothered about yeah. you. And the amount of times you hear these stories about the power of people's eyesight, or as you say, locking eyes with them, that even up until the 20th century, there was so much mysticism attracted and attached to eyes that, you know, I'm sure you've come across this before, where people would often say in murders that the eye would take the picture of the person who'd committed the crime as the last image. It was almost the eye was a camera of some sort. So it's strange that people would consider that even sins that this person was holding in could be transferred in such a way.
Fascinating, isn't it? And there's certainly references to particularly witches in the area having the evil eye. So old Dolly Edgemond, who was from Edgbaston, she was said to have had the evil eye, but she also liked wearing top hats and short skirts. So she seemed like she was a bit of a laugh. And Nanny Morgan, she had the evil eye as well. And it was so scary that no man could call their soul their own when she was in her presence. And there does seem to be a prevalence of the idea and the power of the eyes in folklore, which is fascinating.
When it comes to the history of witchcraft around the United Kingdom, as we might keep saying, there are quite a few notable areas up and down the length and breadth of the country, Amy. What is the particular history in regards to that in Shropshire? Was it widely practiced? I mean, as you touched on there about the grave of the Sin Eater, the thing about Shropshire is it's a very oddly populated county as well, because the north of it seems to be where most people live. The south of it is where you would think most people would want to live, because it's stunningly beautiful.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. So I think witchcraft has always been in Shropshire, and it's always been part of the daily life in Shropshire, probably more so than people in the past would like to have admitted. So, for instance, there's a tale that Charlotte Byrne recalls in A Sheaf of Gleanings, that she says that a vicar moved to the Clee Hills area, which is absolutely stunning. And he wasn't from Shropshire, he was from the area, but he moved there, took on the parish, and then he was absolutely disgusted to see that there was a prevalence in the belief of witches and also in practices of witchcraft in the area. So he rushes home and he's going to write a sermon about how evil witchcraft is. But he happens to tell the local schoolmaster, and in almost Wicker Man style fashion, the local schoolmaster basically threatens him and says, you know, I wouldn't be doing that if I were you. If you write a sermon about the evils of witchcraft and make out witchcraft isn't real, you'll make more enemies round here than you will friends. So I think that's a snapshot into the idea of the prevalence of witchcraft. And there's even witches that exist into the 18th and 19th centuries, when we're supposed to be quote unquote a civilized time with industry and all that kind of thing. There's still a very strong belief in the power that these witches can have. So for instance, one of the latest ones I've seen is a lady known as Molly Delight, who lived at the foot of the Wrekin, and that was in 1950s, and she was said to have the evil eye. She kept cats and toads like every self-respect in witchcraft in Shropshire. And she was said to be able to turn into a cat as well.
Yeah.
And in all likelihood, that is probably just children telling stories about a slightly strange older lady who lives at the foot of the Wrekin. But that belief in witchcraft and that belief in the existence of witches is still seen and is still prominent. And I think there's no witch that typifies that as much as Nanny Morgan in the area. So Anne Morgan was born, I reckon, around 1796-ish. And she was born into an area just outside of Much Wenlock. Nothing really to report of her early life, apart from the fact she lives in quite a nice house. But then in the early 1800s, when she was working in service, she gets caught on the rob. So she's been nicking from the lady who owns the house with another girl. And she ends up going to prison for it. Now, she's come off lucky, to be honest, because the other girl ends up going to being transported.
Mm.
So Nanny Morgan ends up going to prison for some time. But she's kind of in a bit of a predicament when she comes out. She's been disowned by her mother and father. She's been disowned by the community because she's a thief. And she's not really got any prospects, because no one wants to employ her. The area is incredibly insular, so everybody knows everybody's business. There's no hope of her getting a husband because she's a thief. And it really causes her a lot of distress. She ends up being homeless. And there's a threat of the workhouse looming over her. But then she happens upon the travelling community. Now, the travelling community, they do play quite a prominent part in certain aspects of Shropshire life, because they would often come into Shropshire and work as itinerant workers. So they'd work on the farm, help with the harvest, and then move on to the next farm. And she happens upon a group of those, and she explains her situation, and they welcome her with open arms. And this is really the start of Nanny Morgan's life, but also the events that would actually cause her downfall. So she becomes a travelling woman, and the newspapers report that she's taken to unchristian ways, so one can only imagine what she gets up to. She sounds like she's having a right good time. and she learns how to read palms and read cards and do tarot and curses and potions and really all the kind of trappings of the occult she learned during the time with the travelling community. Now, this gives her a means of supporting herself that she would never have got if she'd have stayed in the archetypal idea of what a woman should be in Victorian England. And she really loves it. She really enjoys the lifestyle she has. And she ends up being really good at it as well. She disappears off the radar for a little bit, but then one day, unexpectedly, she waltzes into Much Wenlock, tells everyone she's moving into her dad's old house because he's died, and she sets up shop, essentially, in this house. So in this house, she starts selling her trade, and you've got people from all over Shropshire and even people as far as Herefordshire coming into Much Wenlock to have their fortune told, to read palms, to buy curses and potions from this woman. And it's not like they're even just superstitious country folk like you'd stereotypically think. People and ladies of great standing and education that buy from Nanny. And she ends up getting, as a lot of people who do this kind of thing, reputation for being a witch. Now, at first, you get the idea that that might have caused her some problems, but then as time goes on, she starts to kind of play up to the stereotype. So, which I think is personally brilliant, but she starts keeping a load of animals, particularly cats, and she's got a few dogs. She starts keeping cats, and they've all got brilliant names like Hellblow and Satan's Smile. And my other favourite fact about her animals is she keeps a whole box of toads. And in this box of toads, she's got one that's her favourite, which she smothers and kisses in public and feeds communion wafers. interestingly, it's said that Molly Delight in the 50s fed her toads communion wafers. So I'm not sure whether it's actually part of a diet in Shropshire, but this toad eats communion bread and wafers. Nanny Morgan ends up being kind of a commodity to the area because they want her to be reading fortunes, but ostracized for doing the exact thing that they want her to do. Unfortunately, Nanny Morgan ends up being murdered by her toy boy, which in itself is it typifies the way she lived her life. Now, she lived with a man who was 35 and she was in her 60s. Mm. And he was called William Davis. And William Davis described by the newspapers at the time of her murder as a weak, silly and inoffensive fellow. So it's really the character reference you kind of want. And him and her are clearly, in my opinion, in some form of romantic entanglement or relationship. It's more than just lodgers. And they raise a few eyebrows in the community because people would rather believe that this wicked witch had seduced poor William, and him under her spell than a young man could ever love an older woman.
Yeah.
But their relationship is pretty rocky, and it seems that they were very ill-fitted for each other, and there's a lot of poor behaviour on each person's part. And one day, the 12th of September, 1853, she sends William into town with some of her money, because the money she makes from fortune-telling would make her be a very, very wealthy woman by today's standards. So she sends him out to get some food for tea because she wants to cook a nice meal for tea. And William goes and spends it all in the pub. Mm. And then he, clever as he is, he staggers back home to try and get some more money for the pub. So they have this blazing row in the street, and everyone, all the neighbours, are probably twitching. And then the argument actually spills into the house, and that's when William murders Nanny Morgan, and he stabs her in the carotid artery and in the face, and she's got wounds to her wrist. She's in a terrible way, and she's actually passing away from her injuries. And tragically, it's said that only her dog is the only thing that mourns her in this world. So when they found her body, they found this dog refused to leave her side and was mourning and was howling and howling because his mistress died. Now, the interesting thing about Nanny Morgan's death, which I think really demonstrates our attitude to witches, not just in Shropshire country, is that rather than her being seen as a victim of domestic violence or a victim of abuse or a murder victim, she's seen as the problem, and she's seen as the reason why she was murdered. So this argument, and it later gets used in William's defence, that she had bewitched him and he was in some sort of magical thraldom, and the only way that he could escape this was by killing her. Because there's an old belief that if you shed the blood of a witch, the witch will break, it breaks the spell.
Mm.
So you think that this might be the sort of thing that might be being said in the street, but this was used in court, and newspapers as far as like the Huddersfield Advisor and newspapers in Australia were reporting this murder case and saying that she was a witch and that she had bewitched William. And it was almost a blessing that they had done this. And even people in the town, such as the mayor, believed that she was a witch and that she was killed possibly for a positive reason. And he even took steps to stop her wicked books and her objects being brought into the local community or the town gaining a ghost. They gathered all of the things into the centre and burnt them.
Oh.
And it's shocking to think that this was the sort of thing that was happening in the 1850s, because it feels medieval, it feels early modern, but this was happening 150 years ago. And he did get sentenced to, he got sentenced to death first, but then it was changed to penal servitude and he got sent to Australia. And this is where the folklore and the real story kind of entwines, because folklore says that Nanny Morgan got her revenge and she sunk the ship and he drowned. But all we know is that he was sentenced to that. But I think this story really shows the way we see witches in society, but also it challenges this idea that if a woman exists outside of the parameters of what's normal, she is somehow wrong or evil. And I do feel for Nanny Morgan, and I wish more people knew about her, but also that she didn't have to die in the way that she did.
Yeah. Is it one of those situations, Amy, where as we've become more learned and not accepted this kind of character assassination of someone just being a bit different to what people expect, has she gone under some kind of renaissance that has allowed people to sort of celebrate her and visit where she lived and thrived? Or is this one of these things that it's only recently coming to light and we're now starting to see a bit more progressive thought in regards to her and her history?
To my understanding, it's only recently really come into light. So I heard of Nanny Morgan growing up, because I didn't grow up too far away from Much Wenlock. The thing I heard about her was that she was a wicked witch who seduced young men, and she got killed, murdered by the man she seduced, and her ghost now stands on Westwood Common, which is near where she lived, seducing young men. And if a man happens to look into this ghost's eyes, he will love no other but her for the rest of his life. And that was a story I really grew up and kind of accepted at first. And it was only really when I started looking into things a bit more detail in the newspapers, because I went through a stage of trying to match any of our ghost stories with newspaper reports or anything to do with things in the newspaper, that I uncovered the story of this woman that was actually real for a start, and that she, and the full extent of it. And I think certain people have touched upon the fact that she was murdered, or the fact that she was in the community, she was seen as a witch. But I think one thing I've really tried to do with my research is demonstrate that she was a person, and that she, even if it was against the norms of the time, and she was a strong, fiery woman that cut her own path, she was still vulnerable. And ultimately, she was vulnerable to the people closest to her, and she couldn't escape that kind of weight of the patriarchy, because by William murdering her, it was almost in a way like the patriarchy catching up with all those years where she'd been herself and cut her own path. So I think it's certainly coming to light a lot more now, and I'm doing everything I can as one person to try and champion her and show that she would have been a fantastic person. Who, she was a businesswoman, she run her own business, and there's people nowadays that do card reading or tarot cards and make a tidy sum out of it, and she was doing all that back then. So I think it is interesting to see the way perception changes a person.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And I think as we see it more and more in this day and age, that there are some real sort of groundswells of support for some of these horrendous cases and murders that were brushed off or done in the name of protecting the population, and people are trying to get people posthumously pardoned and monuments erected for them, Amy. So I think anything like that that allows us to look back in a proper sense and allow these people the credit they deserve should be supported and applauded. So let's hope that her fight goes on long into the night.
Hopefully, yeah. I feel like I've never escaped her. I feel like from the first time I kind of realised that she wasn't just this wicked witch, she's kind of been there poking me, going, tell my story, tell her. And she really, there's certain cases that I've researched that have never really left me, and she's one of them. And I think they're always the ones that need telling. They're always the ones that have kind of faded into the night a little bit, so we need to shout them and turn them into war cries.
There is something about a lot of these stories in Shropshire that the Wrekin seems to be a real sort of centre point for a lot of strange things and strange stories. I love the fact that this hill that's not quite a mountain is, or rather has, two origin stories, which I find very odd, Amy, because although they both involve giants, they are very drastically different stories.
Yes, they are.
Now, this is one of those things that, in the vast majority of England, we don't tend to get many stories about giants. There might be a few from Cornwall, and obviously Wales and Ireland and Scotland have lots of stories. But England seems a bit poorly represented when it comes to the world of giants wandering around. And yet Shropshire seems to have been quite popular with them. Well, most of them anyway, Amy, as we'll find out in a second. But do you think that's because of the proximity to Wales that there are stories of giants in the county? Or do you just think it's, once again, it's another unique aspect of the folklore of Shropshire?
It would be wrong to suggest that Wales hasn't influenced these stories, because you see, as you get closer to the border, there's a place called Ogo's Hole, and that's said to be a giant's burial. And it's again, it's a smaller hill than the Wrekin, but it's still quite a big hill with a cave underneath. And there's a story of this Welsh giant who has been buried. His wife actually is buried down in this hole.
Mm.
And with her is a great treasure. And anyone that finds the treasure gets the giant's treasure, and they're perfectly rich. And I think with regards to the Rican, I think the story that I grew up with, the one that I'm probably the best versed with, it would be wrong to miss out the fact that the Rican giant is a Welsh giant. He's Gwendol ap Rican ap Shenkin Min Mawr. The Welsh are terrible, but that's his name. So he's actually a grumpy Welsh giant who hates the town of Shrewsbury so much he wants to absolutely wipe it out of existence. So if you get really a bit esoteric with that all, Shrewsbury in a lot of ways was the centre of the power for Shropshire. It was the centre of justice for Shropshire. And it was also the gateway from Wales into England. So conceivably, the reason why the Welsh giant hates Shrewsbury so much is because it's blocking his way into England and that kind of thing. So I think there's definitely a Welsh influence. And I think it's probably the Welsh has influenced it, but it's developed into something a bit different. And that's through kind of our own perspective, and we put our own slant on it. So I think that's certainly, again, the case with the origin story. The story is replaced, rather than it being a giant, it's the devil again. So there is a version where it's not a giant that tries to flood Shrewsbury, it's actually the devil, and he's just had enough of the place. So I think it's wrong to say that Wales hasn't influenced it, but we've made our own slant on it and made it a bit different, a bit weirder.
Yeah, the devil's a bit of a strange one, because obviously round here we've got Chesterfield, which is known for its crooked spire, Amy.
Yeah.
Which is also responsible, allegedly, by the devil's handiwork, who took a dislike to the area, rather than the fact that it was built out of the wrong type of wood. Anyway, but it is interesting how that, depending where you are, there will be certain places where you'll have these strange stories. But I love a story about a giant, because it reminds me, there's something about that particular story that reminds me of something else, ironically, to do with the devil, which does something very similar to this, that this Welsh giant who's annoyed with Shrewsbury gets tricked by someone, which I think is one of those funny stories that you stumble across sometimes when you come through to myths and legends about certain things, that these giants are big and powerful, but they're not usually the cleverest of folk, are they?
Yeah, no, they're not. Certainly not in the case of Gwendol. He's not bright. but again, it could even be seen as quite wrongly a Welsh stereotype. It could be seen as people in Shropshire kind of going, you know, we're a bit better than the Welsh, even though there's a saying in Shropshire that says Shropshire born, Shropshire bred, strong in the arm and thick in the head. So it's kind of the idea we're going, yeah, we might be that, but we're not the Welsh. Look at them. Look at that Gwendol, he's a silly giant. So I think there is something in that.
There is also, on the Wrekin, there is this wonderful pool, which is it called the Raven's Bowl? Because I've seen the Raven's Bowl, Amy, and this is one of these wonderful little odd things that you'll find somewhere. That on the top of the hill, there's this little sort of spot where, now, I don't know if this is true or not, but it apparently, it doesn't matter how hot it gets, it's always got water in it for some reason.
Yes, supposedly. And if the water runs out, we know that there's a bit of a problem, supposedly. I can't remember if I've ever seen it empty, to be honest, though. So maybe there is something in it when I've been dragged drinking. Not too far from there, there was said to be a hermit that lived there in the medieval period. I think, if I remember right, it was Henry III's time, but I could be wrong.
Mm.
And he was meant to be so holy and so pious, this hermit, and he was called Gilbert, that the king actually wrote to the local magistrate and said, you know what, let him be him, let him do what he's doing, we'll donate a bit of money to give him food, let him carry on praying for God up on the hill. So there was a hermit not too far from there. There's been quite a few hermits actually that have chosen the Wrekin, because there was one in the Anglo-Saxon period as well, but this one had actual king sponsorship. Quite cool.
No, well, that's if nothing, you can wear that as a badge of honor. Oh, I can do what I want. The king said I'm the best there is, so hard line.
Yeah.
And once again, shows the importance that people would place on the county in the monarchy, as you say, with all the people that have been to-ing and fro-ing through it and people having their honeymoons there. So it still allowed people to use it as some kind of important area for them in at any point in history, it would seem. That is very odd. Do you think it's because it's such a striking monument as well in regards to its surroundings in the area, that places like that are often, at any point in history, Amy, you can go to certain parts of England and Scotland and Wales and Ireland, that you will find these places that, even though they're just perfectly normal, natural developments that have formed them, for whatever reason, be it a cave or a gorge or a lovely high point in certain areas, that it seems to have some kind of magnetic effect on everybody that lives near it, that it seems to just draw certain characters to it.
Yes, yeah, I certainly think so. I think if you look at the Wrekin, it's like what you said with maps. If you look at certain maps, there's one in particular that comes to mind from around the 1600s, and Shropshire's got Shrewsbury on it, and then I think there's maybe Ludlow on it, and then lo and behold, there's the Wrekin, and there's a little hill drawn. There's a very jolly looking fellow stood there on the Wrekin, which I always think as the Wrekin giant. But I think when you are driving from Shrewsbury, for instance, or from further afield, and you get to near the Wrekin, it dominates the landscape. It's as far as the eye can see. And there's a saying which I think is very true to myself, that a Shropshire man is in love if he can see the Wrekin. And I think there's a real sense of place that's attached to it. I know with myself, the Wrekin symbolises home to me. I grew up in the shadow of the Wrekin. It dominated my vision, literally. But also, it was kind of the axis of my own world. I remember when I was a child, I didn't think anything could be higher or taller than the Wrekin. I didn't think there could be... You know, it was almost like I'm on Hen or something almost from Middle Earth to me when I was a child, because I love Lord of the Rings.
Yes.
So I think we are very fond of our little mountain, and I think a lot of people attach the symbolism of home to it. And I think that if that's happening now in the 21st century, that would have been happening 300, 400, however many hundred years ago, that the people who lived around the Wrekin would have seen it as important. And if you go back right up until kind of the Roman times and just before with the Celts, there was people that lived up the Wrekin. It was a hill fort. And I think you can feel, as you, apart from the fact that you're really out of breath walking up there, if you're anything like me, you can feel the age of the place, and you can almost imagine everybody that has put their feet on that ground and travelled the same route as you. And there's something almost quite pagan about it, really. It's a tangible connection to the history of the area.
There is something quite awe-inspiring. I remember many years ago going to Scotland, and we stopped in the little place next to Ben Nevis, Amy. And there's something, well, I think when we live in this country, we're a bit sort of, you know, unless you live in certain areas, you might see a big hill and that's about it often. But there are certain places, obviously in Wales and Scotland and certain parts of the England as well, where you will come across this. I remember standing on the shores of the loch that's next to Ben Nevis, just being absolutely awestruck, thinking, bloody hell, that's massive. And then thinking, well, if that's big, how big is a real mountain, you know, when you think about things like the Himalayas or the Alps, and you just think it is awe-inspiring regardless. And when it's something that sticks out so far, that gives you such, and the other aspect of this is as well that on a clear day, you can see for miles and miles and miles, you can see into other counties.
Yes, you can, yeah.
So it doesn't surprise me at all that you would have these magnetising places for people throughout time. And obviously now it's extremely popular for people who want to sort of see how fit they really are, Amy.
Yes. I think it's interesting as well, because in the 1800s, we had these things called the Wrekin Wakes. Now, the Wrekin Wakes were like a big celebration where everyone in the local community, so we're thinking Wellington and conceivably maybe even the Iron Bridge area, would walk up the Wrekin, and there would be coconut shies and even fairground rides sometimes, and as you get into the later 1800s, and great dances and fizzy pop and all sorts of fun and merriment. and it would be at the top of the Reekin. And the Reekin Wakes culminated in essentially a massive brawl. and this is, it's just one of my favourite things. So it would farmers against all of the local miners, and they would have this massive brawl to see who was the king of the hill.
Right.
And if one group looked like they were winning before the other group, and before the crowd had kind of, if the crowd wanted more entertainment, and they, you know, the one side looked like they were winning, they would send some poor chap to run down the Reekin, run to the local area and gather up support for people fighting at the top. So he must have had calves of absolute steel or iron to be able to do that. But it shows that this area has been more than a hill. And you see it even now, the certain days of the year that you'll meet every man and his dog and your neighbour and your old teacher and everything when you walk up the Reekin. And that would have been exactly the same 100 years ago. And I think that's what's quite special about it, is that it's always been part of our community.
Remarkable. I love the fact that you just have a really good day and then finish it all with a big punch up.
Yeah, it was scrap. Brilliant. But the local community, actually, the local community loved their Reekin Wakes, but the people that owned the Reekin, because it is private land, were so disgusted by this behaviour and this ungodly, unchristian devilment, that they would actually send people up to break the scrap up. But unfortunately, there are some cases, particularly with some of the poachers that were sent up, where they just join in. And eventually the Reekin Wakes were banned, but it is a practice that I think maybe the Reekin could benefit from reviving.
Yeah, have your fisticuffs on the top of the hill out of the way, everybody. Go on, off you go.
Yeah, go on. Farmers versus miners.
Yeah, to be fair, if you're that annoyed with someone, if you can still have a fight after climbing up that hill, Amy, then fair play, I think. It should be
you
a
must be bloody annoyed.
Usually you'd be that tired, you go, oh, let's just shake hands, let's move on.
Come on, let's have a lemonade and go on the coconut shy.
Oh, brilliant, brilliant. Well, one of the other wonderful, weird stories I've always been attracted to in your locality is this very strange creature known as the Shropshire Man Monkey.
Oh, yes.
So, what on earth is this all about, Amy? Because I've heard about this and read snippets here and there over the years, but I've never really spoken to anybody who can give me the lowdown. What on earth is the Shropshire Man Monkey?
I love the man monkey. There are several theories as to what he could be, whether or not he is a spirit. And we do certainly have animal spirit in Shropshire. For example, there's everything from black dogs to phantom donkeys and phantom pigs. We've got animal spirits. Or he is something more tangible and a bit more like a cryptid. So we'll set the scene. In 1879, Charlotte Byrne, who is the absolute authority for Shropshire folklore in the 1800s, she heard reports of this event that happened on the Shropshire Union Canal, where a man who was riding down the canal trying to get from one place to the other happened upon this strange snarling creature that looked a lot like a monkey. Now, this creature leapt out from seemingly out of nowhere, really, and attached itself to the back of his horse and was snarling and smiling and genuinely looked terrifying. So this man was absolutely terrified. The horse was terrified. They didn't know what was going on. So he did all that he could really do with the tools he had at the time and started whipping it with his horse whip in hope that the horse whip would knock the creature off him and he could ride away. However, the horse whip went through the creature, and the creature had a bit of a translucent appearance, which makes some people believe that it might have been a spirit. So he abandons his horse, abandons the horse whip and leaves it on the canal, and he runs to an area that's nearby, and it actually has a pub. So he checks in at the inn. He refuses to speak to anybody for a couple of days, absolutely terrified by what's happened. So the locals get a bit worried about him, and they think, well, you know, there's a stranger and he's gibbering and he's a bit of a nervous wreck. Let's get the police involved. So they get the local constable to come round, and they're thinking maybe that there was an attack or violence, anything violence on the canal. So they managed to calm man down and talk to him, and he speaks to this police officer and he explains what's happened. And then the police officer kind of scoffs at him and goes, oh, just that always happens, which is brilliant. And he says that ever since a man killed himself not too far from where the man monkey was seen, this apparition, this creature, had been forming and having similar instances. So that's the first real instance that we have written down about the man monkey. And Charlotte Byrne went to the actual scene and she took evidence and she was very methodical in recording this story. However, some people have believed that it might be a bit more like a cryptid or an actual ape, because not too far away in, I think it was 1888, could be wrong on that date, in Birmingham, there was a creature, similar stories of this creature terrorizing the community on the canals that was actually tangible. It was actually an ape, very tall, very large humanoid ape. And that story was called Old Ned's Devil. Now, Old Ned's Devil was eventually shot and killed, which showed he was an actual living creature rather than a spirit, and he was displayed in the local pub. So there was some belief that maybe Old Ned Devil could be the man monkey, because the canals kind of touch, but the stories don't, in my opinion, correlate. And there have been sightings of the man monkey since on the Shropshire Union Canal. My favourite is from the 80s, where this family, this poor, unsuspecting family from, I think they were from Norfolk, had decided to go on a canal holiday, and they took the canal and they were sailing down the Shroppy, which is Shropshire Union Canal, and it's absolutely beautiful. There's a lot of greenery. The dad's driving the boat, the children and the wife are in the boat, and he looks up at one of the bridges he's about to go under, and he sees this giant ape-like creature smiling and waving at him. And he absolutely, the blood runs cold, fear in his body, what have I seen? So he shouts his wife, he shouts his children to try and, you know, get someone else to see this creature. But then by the time they've come out and gone, you know, what's wrong with you, the creature's gone. And I just love the idea of this almost reverse Bigfoot kind of wanting people to see him on the Shropshire Union Canal. But I just think it's brilliant. But there have been a few other sightings of maybe grey shapes or dark shapes on the canal. But I think canonically, it's probably safe to say that maybe the Shropshire Man Monkey was a spirit entity in the 1870s, particularly with it being associated with a suicide, because there are other instances in Shropshire of suicide victims ending up becoming animal spirits. And there are several reports of that in Shropshire. But I do think, even if it is a cryptid, that Old Ned's Devil is a separate cryptid to the Shropshire Man Monkey. But it's just one of the brilliant, bizarre little creatures that we have in Shropshire. For instance, in 2007, someone reported seeing pterodactyls flying over Whitchurch. And she lived near a nature reserve, so she was quite well versed in birds. And all of a sudden she heard this almighty screech, and she saw two great pterodactyls flying over her head. Told her husband, her husband probably was like, what on earth's wrong with you, you know, do I need to call someone? And then 2 days later her son saw the same thing. So she did a test where she looked through different birds with him, because he was quite young, and said, you know, what about this bird? No, it wasn't that, mum. What about this bird? And then she popped up the picture of the pterosaur amongst the pictures, and he was like, no, it's that I've seen. So they were seen in Whitchurch, and they were also seen on the Silken Way, which is in near where a poor unsuspecting fella was walking home from work, and one supposedly swooped down at him and tried to get him. So we have dinosaurs too.
I'm always intrigued by strange tales of people encountering monkey-like creatures in the UK. Because the only other direct thing I can think of is that weird shug monkey creature that's supposed to hang around in Cambridgeshire and Suffolk, Amy. So when you hear these stories, along with that that rather rude ghost monkey that's supposed to live in a stately home in Dorset, someone tell me. So anything like that always makes me smile a great deal. Because they are just so peculiar.
There's just no real reason for them to be. You know, it's not even like, obviously there's zoos and we've had contact with apes through things like that, but it's not like we have an indigenous creature that could even look a little bit like that. Like, there's nobody could mistake that, for instance, for a monkey. So there's no real reason for it to happen. It's just one of the beautiful eccentricities of this country.
Yes. that's certainly one term for it, I'd say. I mean, when you've been diving into this, one of the other facets of folklore that I love is black dog stories, Amy.
Yeah.
Have you been able to uncover them? Because I know certain... This is another thing, like we're talking about the strange folklore of England especially, that often when people look at it, they'll say, oh, well, everybody was telling the same kind of tales. And I think sometimes it's very noticeable that there are certain counties when it comes to black dog lore that have hundreds. You know, when you talk about Norfolk and Suffolk and probably East Yorkshire, seem to have so many of them. And then certain places like Wiltshire and Cambridgeshire, there doesn't seem to be that many. What's Shropshire like when it comes to these kinds of tales?
So we definitely have some. I wouldn't say we have as many as some areas. And they tend to be associated a lot of the time with suicide. So people that may have suicided end up in some areas, particularly Bath Church in North Shropshire, they end up being black dogs. So there is an area, a road outside Bath Church, and there's this great black dog with fiery red eyes that's meant to stalk the roads. And there's some, according to folklore, there was a suicide that happened on that road, or a suicide was buried at the crossroads there. So there's that kind of negative association that maybe that very negative emotions that drive the person to the unthinkable could manifest in this creature. Another one that springs to mind is Wild Edric. Now, Wild Edric has a whole heap of folklore around himself. He's got his fairy bride, and he was a bit similar to kind of Herod the Wake in the idea that he was fighting against the Normans kind of thing. But he is said to walk around the Long Mynd in the form of a great black dog. And he's meant to turn up as well whenever there is a crisis or there's a problem within England, and that can be in the form of a black dog or it can be in the form of a man. So they're two off the top of my head, but we do have a lot of very strange kind of animal ghosts or apparitions. So we have, for instance, the Wrekin has an albino fox ghost not too far from the Cuckoo's Cup. And the Raven's Bowl, there's this great, quite bigger than a normal, kind of, I would imagine it'd be the size of kind of like an Akita, because it's described as bigger than a fox, much bigger than a fox, but this albino fox with fiery red eyes that to appear and then disappear. And there's even roads outside, on the outskirts of Welshpool and outskirts on the way to Welshpool, the Shropshire side, that have ghosts of donkeys. And the ghost, there's one in particular that there was a apparition of a donkey lying down on the floor, and it was so real that the man who happened to be walking that way thought that somebody's donkey had died. So he went over to kick it, and just as he kicked it, it turned into an apparated away, and it was dusted into the ether. So we do have several ghostly animals, and they kind of are dotted around the whole area. But as far as black dogs are concerned, it's very few and far between.
Oh, well, no doubt. I think if you keep digging into your county's strange and wonderful history, Amy, I would not be surprised if more come to light, though.
Not, probably.
Maybe that's not a good thing. I'm not too sure. So,
possibly.
Is there anything that, whilst you've been following up with this passion, Amy, that you've discovered about the county or your local folklore that's given you the chills, or you think is probably the county's most frightening thing you've come across so far?
So, I think it was an experience I had at Little Abbey. Now, I tend to be more on the believing side of the paranormal than skeptic, but I'd like to say I was a skeptical believer. But I always try and keep my personal views about the paranormal away from my folklore and my study of ghosts, because to me, ghost stories are kind of a conduit for the attitudes and fears and the culture that they come from. And they can give us a window into the history of the time. And Lillishall Abbey has a haunted monk that is said to appear near the where the altar would be. And he, if you go over to him, he's meant to rush forward to you and almost seem solid and ask you, have you found the secret before disappearing? Which is quite a cool story. And I'd never really thought much. I'd written about it. I'd written about the actual, because a murder took place, supposedly, according to folklore, at Lillishall Abbey of one of the monks. But I didn't really think anything of it, to be honest. It wasn't one, because I think because I grew up near Bildworth Abbey, which is another abbey that has a spooky ghost monk, I'd always invested a bit more time in that story than the Lillishall one. But my partner and I, we went to Lillishall last year, and it just felt really weird. Do you know when a place has an atmosphere? And we were walking around, and first it was deadly silent. Muggy, almost uncomfortable days anyway, but it almost amplified when we were there. And all you could hear was the wasps, because there was a wasp's nest. And sometimes wasps have one of the curses of being a folklorist is you tend to kind of link things, but there are an association with wasps and the devil. So I'm there thinking that, but we kind of calm down, and I keep seeing something out of the corner of my eye, and I keep like a black shape, because near one of the big archways, and it almost looks like somebody wearing a hoodie kind of looking around the archway and then looking away. But there was nobody else there apart from myself and my partner. So we were walking around, and my partner's a bit more of a skeptic than me, so I thought, I'm not going to make myself look silly and, you know, ask him if he's seeing things. I just carried on. And then we got to one of the rooms. It's a very, very dark room. It's only little alcove, really, and I felt like I had a pair of hands stopping me from going in the room. And it was the only way I can describe it is it's like a very physical sensation rather than like, oh, something's stopping me going in here. I felt almost as if yourself had been stood in front of me, or anyone kind of going, no, you can't go in here.
Yeah.
Whereas my partner could walk in, and he felt, which is very strange for him because he is quite skeptical, hand, almost like a hand brush his arm. And he grew up in like, he went to Catholic school, and he grew up in kind of a semi-Catholic household. He doesn't practice, so him being himself having a bit of a laugh, he went, hey, oh, you can pack that in, I'm a Catholic. And he said he almost felt the hand go from being on his arm to moving, and that freaked him out a little bit, because he's not really a believer. So I couldn't go in that room. But we were walking around, and I still kept thinking that I could see this shape, this black hooded shape in the corner of my eye. And then I said to my partner, I said, right, Callum, just stand there and look directly forward, almost like as if you let your eyes lose focus. What can you see? And he went, do you want me to be honest with you? And I was like, yeah, kind of the point of this exercise is for you to be honest with me. And he said, I keep seeing a black shape kind of looking. And I was like, right, okay, this is creepy, because that's what I can see. And I'd never really seen anything like that before. And we felt like we'd only been there about 20 minutes, because it got a bit spooky a bit quickly. And we were like, right, let's go. Yeah. I've had some pictures taken, let's leave. And then when we actually got back to the car and looked at the clock, we'd been there over an hour and a half, and we couldn't account for the time that we'd been there. And it was very bizarre. It almost felt very drained afterwards, and a lot tireder, and really quite bizarre feeling, but we could not account for that missed time. So afterwards, I'm in the process of writing about the show for Haunted Magazine, because I want to kind of go into all of its history, because they at one point in the 40s, they were so convinced that there was something happening there that they actually floodlit it, and they got the electric company to floodlight the area, because kept hearing screams and shouts and blood-curdling shouts coming from the underground, because it's got a series of tunnels underneath it. So I'm doing my research, but I thought it'd be good to put the feelers out a little bit. So I asked on just Twitter and Facebook, Shropshire groups, and anyone I could really think of, has anyone had a strange experience at Lillishall? And the amount of people that had similar experiences to myself and my partner, or had seen things or heard things, was really quite scary, really, because it made it a lot more tangible. And even there was people that had contacted me and said that they'd gone there when they were in their teens with their teenage partner, hoping to get a bit lucky, not to be too blue. And then they'd gone and they'd seen a load of weirdos practicing magic. And that is probably just people being pagan, but yes. They said that they didn't carry on with what they planned to do when they'd gone there, because they saw these people and they kind of drove off. But it seems that this area, Lushall Abbey, it has a cool folk story, but there's a lot more to it than just the folk story, and it seems to have a real presence. And I think if I was to put myself out on a limb and say it's probably the most haunted feeling place I've been to, because there's other areas and there's other places I've been to that have an atmosphere, or you can quite easily see how the ghost story has developed from that area. But Lillishall Abbey felt different, and it felt quite scary and quite dark. Mm. And then there was the physical sensations that myself and my partner had. So it was just very weird.
Yeah.
So I'd probably go with there.
Wow. I mean, that's not something you would normally ascribe to a paranormal event, this loss of time. You would usually put that when we're talking about maybe the Fae or alien abductions. That's one of the first times I've heard of that kind of aspect of a haunting where you completely lost track of time. And
we cannot account for this time, because we felt like probably maximum that we'd been there about half an hour, because it was a quick kind of scoot round, and then I think we both freaked ourselves out with the certain things that had happened. So we were like, right, let's go, because usually where my partner and me go to like other historical sites, we spend a bit of time there. We've even been known to take like Nightmares Morris or Naffletaffel, like Viking and medieval board games, and sit and play them in the actual medieval ruins. And we certainly didn't want to do that at Urshel. It was very spooky.
Well, if something like that makes you want to leave somewhere, Amy, I would suggest it's definitely haunted.
Yes. Usually I'm like, bring it on, more spookier the better, but I wasn't like that day.
So along with your blog and as you've mentioned, writing for Haunted Magazine, you've also dipped your toe into the world of audio drama, Amy. So how's that going, and what's it about?
It's amazing. I'm still a little bit in shock, to be honest, because I started writing it nearly 2 years ago now. So I had lots of versions of the script and getting to know the script intimately and even down to the last punctuation mark. But then to hear it come to life, it's a bit like, wow, this is something I did. What's this all about? So it's a bit surreal, but it's amazing to see that people are enjoying it and are able to be exposed to Shropshire folklore in a new and different way. So The Best of Men is all about the devil, believe it or not. I know that's quite shocking with me.
Yeah.
And it's centered around the Stiper Stones. So the Stiper Stones has a rock formation on it called the Devil's Chair. And the Devil's Chair is said to use it to sit upon and look over the whole of Shropshire. And on the 21st of December, the winter solstice, he calls forth all his most wicked followers, all of his witches and warlocks, to judge them for the King of Evil or Queen. And whoever's been the most wicked gets to be the most evil person, the King or Queen of Evil for the year. As well as that, it's also a time when newer people who want to be evil make promises to the devil and in turn get rewards from him. So it's a bit of a bargain in time, really. So there's a report of a chap who was a geologist in the 30s who was said to have had quite a weird experience on the Stiperstones, and he saw these people dancing and this inhumanly tall figure, and it really spooked him. But then you don't really hear anything else. So I wanted to follow that story on and imagine how having such a paranormal experience would impact a person.
Mm-hmm.
So I followed his story through to his grandson, and his grandson is Jack, who is one of the protagonists of the story, who is researching the devil in Shropshire to try and put a stop to him, he says. Not to give too much away, but he tells people that he wants to stop the devil. Now, it just so happens that Jack is best friends with Britain's bad boy skeptic, who is currently the star lead man of Paranormal Takedown, which is one of the biggest paranormal shows in Britain. And he's an absolute arsehole, to put it bluntly. He's in a way, I suppose he's like if Piers Morgan took the paranormal.
Yes.
He's not a very nice man. But the narrative really surrounds these 3 days before the solstice. The idea and these devil narratives, but the idea that this TV show is going to take on the devil. And I think it's quite interesting because a lot of modern paranormal shows are obsessed with demons. And everything's a demon, particularly the American ones. It's this is a demon, this is a demon. So it's quite interesting to have that dynamic and play with what would happen if a paranormal show actually met a demon, actually met the devil. So it's all kind of really about that folklore and how that folklore necessarily influences the area and the landscape.
Mm, fabulous. Fabulous.
Thank you.
So I'm just wondering what else you can... What other strings to your bow you can add, Amy, with everything else that you've got going on? So, as you've touched on, you're doing an article in regards to your experience for Haunted Magazine. You're continuing to uncover things for your marvellous blog about all things weird in Shropshire, and also this audio drama. Anything else? Any other irons in your fire at the moment?
So I'm very slowly writing a book on Shropshire Ghosts.
Ah.
I've not got any plan how, I don't know how I'll publish it yet or anything like that. But I'm trying to collect all the lesser known stories. So they're all the stories that I believe should be told in Shropshire. The problem is I keep uncovering stories and I keep thinking they need to be told.
Yeah.
So that's why it's being slowly written. But that's something I'm doing. And I'm hoping possibly we might be getting a follow on from The Best of Men because people seem to really like it and people seem to want to know what's happening next. So me and the producer are in discussions at the moment about how we could continue the narrative, particularly because certain people might have sold their soul to the devil. So certain people might need to go back in a year's time to do what the devil wants them to. So that's really exciting.
Oh, brilliant. Brilliant. Well, Amy, it's been a real pleasure speaking with you and having you guide me around your county's strangest sites. Where can everybody follow your work, find your blog, and keep up to date with anything else you've got going on?
Yes, so I'm predominantly on Twitter. I don't tend to use many other social media sites. So I'm Goblin Egg on Twitter, which is, I love goblins, but the O for goblin is a zero. With regards to my blog is nearlyknowledgeablehistory.blogspot.com. And if you want to listen to my audio drama, for instance, that is, it's been produced by Alternative Stories and Fake Realities podcast. So if you search them, you should be able to find the link. And it's The Best of Men, my audio drama through them. And apart from that, I think that's pretty much everywhere you can find me.
Brilliant. Well, I'll put links to everything in the show notes for everybody.
Thank you.
And hopefully they will come and discover lots of wonderful, weird things as I have over the last 2 or 3 years reading your blog, Amy. So thank you for being such a gracious host to your county's strangeness. And I wish you all the very best. And hopefully when that ghost book's out, I'll have another chat with you and you can scare the pants off me in that regard.
That'd be brilliant. Yes.